sunshine-spattered terrace. Matter of some urgency, apparently. It was a brilliant blue Bermuda day, but embankments of purple cloud were stacking up out over the Atlantic. Storm front moving due east. Hawk put down the book he was reading, a wonderful novel called The Sea by John Banville. Made her want to read every word the man had ever written. Thank you, Pelham. Won't you show him out?
I shall indeed, my lord.
Offer him a bit of refreshment, will you please?
But of course, your lordship.
Pelham withdrew soundlessly back into the shadows of the house. Hawk smiled as he watched the old fellow retreat. These stilted conversational formalities had not been necessary for years, but it was something Hawk and his octogenarian friend, Pelham Granville, found so amusing they continued the charade. Both men found an odd reassurance in these hoary Victorian exchanges. It was a code they shared, and the fact that an outside observer would find them old-fashioned and ridiculous made their secret all the more enjoyable. Moments later, Ambrose Congreve walked out onto the terrace at Tea Kettle Cottage with a big smile on his face. He was wearing a three-piece white linen suit with a navy blue bow tie knotted at his neck and a white straw hat on his head, something Tennessee Williams might have conjured up. He was even dabbing his forehead with a white linen handkerchief, as Big Daddy might have done. Congreve had been busy. He had spent the last 2 days at his home office at Shadowlands, sifting through mobile intercepts, old dossiers, photographs, all the reams of highly classified material Brick Kelly had forwarded out from Langley. And judging by appearances this morning, the famous criminalist had come up with the goods.
"Oh, hello, Ambrose,"
Hawk said, raising his sunglasses onto his forehead. "Why are you in such a fiendishly good mood this morning?"
"Does it show?"
"You look like you've been sitting in a corner eating canaries all morning." Congreve waved the comment away and sat down on the nearest rattan chair. He carried a lot of excess weight and was always glad of a place to sit.
"Alex, pay attention. This is serious. You don't by any chance know someone, a former high-ranking CIA officer by the name of Artemis Payne, do you?"
Hawk looked up.
"Who did you say?"
"Payne. Artemis Payne."
"You're joking." "No, I assure you that I am not, Alex, joking."
Hawk scratched his chin, realizing he'd forgotten to shave.
"Bermuda did that to you."
"Oh, well, we called him Spider-Man," he said. "Or to his face, just plain Spider. No idea where it came from, but it fit, a rather venomous creature, to be honest."
"Tell me about him."
"Oh, Spider Payne. I know him all right. I worked with him a couple of times in the past. The Caribbean, but Africa mostly. A deeply troubled man. Why?"
"He might be your chap, Alex. You can draw straight lines through the late Stephen Dedalus, CIA head in Dublin, to Cam Hooker at Langley, and now heading Torrance in Paris, and they all intersect in the same place. The doorstep of one Artemis Payne. He's your man, all right. I'd bet the farm on it. Not the whole CIA farm, of course, just my own little lean-to shed down in Lynchburg. Apart from the CIA intersections, is there any other evidence that makes you think that Artemis is our guy?"
Ambrose got to his feet, laced his fingers behind his back, and began pacing back and forth, a little affectation he'd picked up from his idol, the incandescent Sherlock Holmes, Hawk had always assumed.
"Are you quite ready?"
Ambrose said. "Quite."
"Artemis Payne, widely known in the press at the time of his trial as the Spider-Man, currently wanted for kidnapping and suspicion of murder by the French government. Interpol has a standing warrant for his arrest for murder. He received a 30-year sentence in French courts and skipped, disappeared completely."
What triggered all this?" Hawk asked.
"A CIA rendition op gone bad, apparently. Don't forget, this was all shortly after 9/11. A French citizen, a shopkeeper, believed by Payne to be an Al-Qaeda commander, was kidnapped off a Paris street and never seen again by his wife and family. The French police went after Payne for it, arrested and convicted. He appealed to Washington and the CIA for help. The White House disavowed his existence, so did CIA. Payne was politically inconvenient, hung out to dry. There's your motive, obviously."
"Yes."
Payne had lost everything in the aftermath of the trial, his reputation, his house, family, money, the lot of it. He went underground. Nobody's seen him since. Is that really all you have to say? Just after all, mountains of intel I've been sifting through all this last week? Oh, sit down and relax. I know you're wound up about this, but it's bad for your nerves to be so excitable. Alex, you think I drove all the way out here to be... Alex looked up. His blue eyes suddenly gone dead serious as the reality of Ambrose's news sank in. He said, Spider is extraordinarily dangerous. In a bad way, I mean.
There's a good way?
Yeah, people like me. Even you. Ambrose sat back on the planter's chair and accepted another frosty iced tea delivered by Pelham on a silver tray.
Would that be all, sir?
Pelham asked Hawk. Yes, thank you, Pelham. Yes, most kind. Congreve watched this formal exchange with a smile of bemused indulgence and said,
We've now got precisely 1 week. We're going to need a lot of help to find this character, Alex. No trail at all. He went from Europe to Miami to Costa Rica, where two paths diverge in a wood, and there it all goes stone cold. We're going to need formidable manpower and time to track his movements and see where this all leads, so...
Not necessarily.
Well, why not? What are you thinking?
NSA tracks all these guys who go rogue. Emails, texts, mobile calls, obviously. All I need is a number for him. Everyone has a number, no matter where they're hiding.
Then what?
I call him up, out of the blue. Long time no see, Spider. What are you up to these days? Doing well?
Alex, please don't be ridiculous. You don't think that that will arouse suspicion? He knows you have close ties to CIA at the highest levels. He will be waiting for you, poised to sting.
I want him to be suspicious. Listen, he compromised my position once, Morocco, long time ago. I was working out of La Mamounia, running a former Al-Qaeda warlord for months, had him buying Stinger missiles at the underground arms bazaar for me. Spider, who'd always owed the wrong people a lot of money, got offered a tidy sum for my name, and he gave me up. Almost got me killed, the nasty bastard. I went after him with a vengeance. I found him hiding in some hellish rat hole or others in Tangier. I locked myself in with him for 2 days, came as close to turning out his lights as I could without pulling the plug, believe me. I told him if I ever saw his face again, I would bloody well kill him.
He's afraid of you.
Hawk laughed.
I'd say so, yes. I'd say Artemis Payne is very definitely afraid of me.
Then follow the logic, Alex. As soon as he knows you're looking for him, he'll run. He'll dive deep, or worse, he'll lay a trap for you.
I don't think so. You don't know him like I do. I think as soon as he believes that I'm looking for him, he'll come looking for me.
That's what any smart guy like Spider would do. You don't sit around and wait. You don't spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder. No, you go on offense. Eliminate the threat. It's smart. That's what I do, too.
Well, so you want him to come here, to Bermuda?
I do. And believe me, he will.
And then what?
I have no earthly idea. I'm no bloody fortune teller.
What? I have to make it up, Ambrose.
There is that, I suppose.
Right.
And you have to help me, because this guy is good. He's not only smart, he's a vicious killer, and he's utterly ruthless. And to make matters worse, at this point he's got absolutely nothing left to lose.
I wonder, have you been experiencing any suicidal thoughts lately, Alex?
Please, Constable, don't be ridiculous. Many people have tried to kill me over the course of my career, and more often than not, I've managed to show them the folly of that ambition. Congreve uttered one of his trademark sighs of exasperation.
All right, then. What do you need, Alex? I mean right now.
I need people watching the airport, round the clock. People who know what he looks like. Get a likeness from CIA. Also, the same setup at the steamship docks in Hamilton and out at Royal Navy Dockyards where the cruise ship land. I want to know the second Spider-Man sets foot on this island.
Done. What else?
Your brain, if you're not using it at the moment. We need to figure out every last detail of where and how this little reunion should occur.
Congreve said, Do it here.
What?
Right here, Tea Kettle Cottage. Gives you the advantage. Why?
Well, your own turf, that's why. You cannot arrange something like this, Alex. You've got to sit tight and let the fly come to the spider, as it were.
Hawk laughed at that.
As opposed to the spider coming to the fly, who also happens to be a spider.
Don't be rude, Alex. You know I'm only using a rough analogy. I can't help it if his bloody name is Spider, can I? Stop kidding around and pay attention. Your bloody life is at stake here. This cottage is where he will come looking for you, and this is where you should be waiting.
I agree, I suppose. But I don't want Pelham in the house or anywhere near me until this tempest in a tea kettle is over. Can he stay with you and Diana for a few days until this blows over?
Of course. I've a lovely guest room for him at Shadowlands, top floor, right on the sea.
Perfect. Spoil him rotten, will you? He deserves it, God knows.
We'd like nothing better. Now, what else?
I'd like the airport and cruise ship spotters to report to you, not me. As soon as he lands, they alert you. Then you keep track of his movements until he's about to arrive at my doorstep. Just call my house phone. Let it ring 3 times and hang up. Spider's not the type to lob a bomb down the chimney and hope it explodes. He'll want a confrontation. He'll want to talk. He'll want all the drama. Show me how fearless and brilliant he is before he pulls a knife or a gun. That's his style. One of those fellows who always thinks he's the smartest, most dangerous man in the room.
You do realize, Alex, that if we even slightly miscalculated, and this man does manage to kill you, that it is my rather prominent posterior that will be in a ringer with C? I've considered it. Sir David will be extraordinarily pissed off with you. It won't be pleasant. Your life won't be worth living. Please accept my abject apologies in advance.
You'll need a gun, I dare say.
Fox smiled.
You know what my American pal, Stokely Jones Jr., always says when someone tells him something as obvious as that?
I do not. I am a gun.
Chapter 13. The phone rang. Once. Twice. 3 times. Hawk waited. It did not ring again. Game on. Hawk, seated in his armchair facing the door, closed his eyes and concentrated on sensory input. He listened intently, heard nothing amiss. He rested his chin in one hand, periodically sipping his cold coffee, and staring into the pitch-black night beyond his windows. The crackling fire he'd lit earlier now barely provided enough heat to reach his bones. The minutes crawled by, interminable. He fantasized briefly about a short rum and a cigarette, but forced himself to concentrate. See. Hear, smell, feel. Some fluting bird call in the night startled him awake. He sat forward and looked over at the old station clock hung crookedly above the bar. 3 hours had somehow passed. It was almost midnight. Bloody hell, he must have dozed off, despite all the coffee. The log fire had long gone out, and the room felt damp and bone cold. He could see white plumes of warm breath when he exhaled. Beyond his walls, the weather was deteriorating. The wind was up, shrieking, under the eaves and down the chimney. On the seaward side of the house, he could hear the muffled echo of the rolling sea booming on the rocks far below. That cold front he'd seen had moved in over the island after sunset. Now it seemed like it had been raining all evening. The temperature had plummeted, and palm fronds and banana leaves rustled and scratched against the windows. All the old wooden shutters had been made fast against the approaching storm and any random intruder. There was only one way visible inside, and that was through the front door. He sat forward once more, listening. He had heard another kind of noise this time, low and distant, an automobile, its tires hissing on the rain-wet tarmac ribbon of the coast road. He got up from his chair, facing the front door. He moved quickly from one to another of the northern exposure windows, all facing the solid wall of banana trees and the coast road beyond the groves. Turn left out of his drive, and you would eventually wind your way along the coast and reach the Royal Navy dockyards. Turn right, and you had a half hour's drive until you reached the Bermuda airport. The car seemed to be approaching from the right. The sound of hissing tires on asphalt suddenly ended. The driver turned off the main road and onto the sandy lane that led to Hawk's door. Peering out into the darkness of the groves, he could see distant flashes, hazy narrows of light in the rain-drenched night. The flashes soon resolved into steady twin beams of yellowish illumination. Periodically, they would flare up and spike the blackness deep within the impenetrable banana groves. He could see the dense trees out there, their broad green leaves waving wet and storm-tossed like the sea. He was on full alert now. The wavering headland beams would disappear for a few seconds and then reappear after a few seconds closer still, meandering through the grove, stabbing through the trees as if reaching out for him. Each time, a little closer to his cottage, came the spider to the fly. But the fly had no fear. Moments like these were what Alex Hawk had lived and breathed for all his life. He was naturally good at war. His father had always said that he was a boy born with a heart for any fate, and the fate he'd been born for was war. He felt the reassuring weight of his weapon on his right side, a big six-shot revolver, the most reliable weapon in his limited arsenal, here on Bermuda. He was wearing loose-fitting black Kunjo pants from Korea. Strapped to his right thigh was a .357 Colt Python revolver and a nylon swivel holster. It was his Dirty Harry special, the 6-inch barrel with 6 Magnum Parabellum rounds loaded in the cylinder. He wore a black Royal Navy woolen jumper, 4 sizes too big. It came almost to his knees, giving him freedom of movement and concealing his weapon. He'd cut a hole in the right side pocket so he could keep his hand on his gun without it being seen. He was barefoot, despite the cold tiles beneath his feet. Hawk padded silently across the dark room, returning to the wooden armchair facing the door. He sat down and waited. He looked at the clock again. Only 8 minutes had passed since Ambrose called him with the agreed-upon signal. Time was elongated, stretching every minute into 2, 3. A sudden flash of light stretched across the ceiling. Outside, he heard the automobile roll to a stop, some 20 or 30 feet from the entrance. Automobile tires had made a loud crunching sound on the crushed C drive leading up to Teakettle Cottage. A primitive alarm system, perhaps, but it worked. He jumped up and went to the window again, pulling back the curtain just as the headlamps were extinguished. A black sedan, undistinguished. A cheap rental from the airport. Hello, Spider. Because of the car's misty, rain-spattered windows, he couldn't see inside the vehicle. Only the dark silhouette of a large man behind the wheel. He waited for the car's interior lights to illuminate. It remained dark inside. There was no movement at all from the driver, and the 4 doors remained closed. He went back to his chair, sat, and waited in the dark for a knock on the heavy cedar door. It didn't come. The wind had suddenly died down. Cottage was stone silent, save for the ticking of the clock above the bar. No noise or movement inside, nor any noise or movement outside. He tried to imagine what Spider might be doing out there. Just sitting in his car, trying to smoke out his prey? Or trying, somewhat successfully, to psych his opponent out? Enough of this, he thought, reaching for his weapon. He'd go outside and confront the man there. He was about to get out of his chair when his thick wooden front door was suddenly blown inward and off its hinges by a thunderous explosion, a blast of sound and light sufficiently powerful that it blinded him momentarily and disoriented him. His chair was knocked backward, and he hit the floor hard after upending a very solid oak table. He was just vaguely aware that his heavy front door was hurtling through space directly toward him when it crashed against the wall behind him, a few feet above his head, and splintered into vicious flying spikes. He got to his feet, shaking his head to clear it. He was shaken, perhaps, but seemingly unscathed. The room was full of smoke and whirling debris, javelin sharp splinters of wood littering the floor.
"Hello, Hawk,"
a rumbling voice from within the clouds of smoke said. The man was suddenly standing in the doorway, filling the frame. Hawk would have known that voice anywhere, gravelly, edgy, and deep, meant to intimidate. Hawk looked down at his clothes, casually dusting himself off with the back of his hand.
"Oh, next time, try knocking, Spider," Hawk said with a thin smile.
"Right. I'll try and remember that."
All in black, Payne was wearing full night combat fatigues, even a helmet with night vision goggles. He had an M4A1 assault rifle slung from his shoulder and what looked like a Sig Sauer 9mm sidearm on his hip. Someone he knew on this island had access to good stuff, and had provided the assassin with full-bore weapons and gear. Clearly, this was not a social call.
"But then again," Spider added, "there won't be any next time for you and me, old buddy."
He took a few forward steps into the room. "No, I don't suppose that there will be," Hawk said, riding his chair. "I'd invite you in, but you're already in." Hawk realized his voice showed a lot more confidence than he was feeling right now. He was seriously disadvantaged, clearly having made the old mistake of bringing a metaphorical knife to a legitimate gunfight. Definitely outgunned here, the big python suddenly feeling more like a pea shooter. His mind went into overdrive. He needed a new plan. Somehow, he had to remove himself from this confrontation and hit the reset button. Had to keep him talking. Right now, Hawk was in mortal danger, and both men knew it.
"Sorry about your old buddy, Hook," Payne said. "I figured I might hear from you when you heard about the old man's accident."
"The accident?
Yeah, well.
So, you came here to kill me too? You think that I threw you under the bus for that fiasco in Paris?
Nothing to do with it, Spider. I think you got a raw deal. We all did. Everything you did was by the book. Strictly legal operation. I know a lot of other agents who are still pissed at the way you were treated. I'm on your side."
"Save it, Alex. I was on North Haven. I went back for the funeral just to see what I could see. What I saw is you and your bosom buddy, Brick Kelly, huddled up at the back table at the Nebo Lodge. Didn't take much to figure out what you were talking about. Then I get a phone call from you out of the blue. That's why I'm here, Lord Hawk. Preemptive strike. You know the drill."
"Really? Going to be tough to make this one look accidental, Spider. My bloody door blown off the hinges and all?" Alex had both hands in his pockets under the cover of his sweater. He surreptitiously moved his right hand to the Colt Python's grips. He carefully swiveled the holster upward, easing the hammer back to the cocked position, finger-applying light pressure to the trigger, all without Spider seeing a thing.
"I don't give a shit anymore, Alex. Kelly will have the whole goddamn CIA in my ass now. But I plan to stay alive as long as I can and take as many as those agency assholes with me. You understand that kind of thinking, right? Hell, I can see you doing the same damn thing if you got screwed by MI6 the way I did by CIA. Tell me you wouldn't, because I know."
Hawk fired twice, right through the bulky sweater. The heavy mag rounds caught Payne high on his right side. He spun around in a mad pirouette and staggered backward through the doorway and into the rain. At the same time, he brought up the muzzle of his automatic weapon and squeezed off a long burst. The staccato rattled deafening inside the small cottage, bullets spraying everywhere. Hawk dove behind the upended table, a high-powered round splintering bits and chunks of wood all around him. Couldn't remain here a second longer. His cover was disintegrating before his eyes. He popped up and fired again. He missed high and left, but caused Spider to duck down, move sideways on the front steps, and take cover outside, behind the exterior wall. Hawk turned and bolted down the hallway leading to the seaward part of the house toward his bedroom. Despite all the warning signs, he'd seriously underestimated his enemy. Cocky, that was the only word for his stupid behavior. And that's precisely how you get yourself killed in this business. He had a few precious seconds to think his way out of that very scenario. Chapter 14. Hawk dashed inside his room. Spider was right on his heels, pounding down the long hallway after him. Inside the small bedroom, Hawk whirled around and slammed the heavy wooden door behind him. He double-bolted it and then slid his large mahogany dresser in front of it, thinking about how this would play out, trying to see it in his mind. Spider had come prepared for all-out war. He was wearing ceramic body armor plates inside his combat jumpsuit. In order to survive, Hawk had to put a round between one of the seams between the armor plates and hope to hit a vital organ. And how the hell do you do that staring down the barrel of a roaring machine gun throwing lead at you? He looked around the room, trying to subdue the panic that was creeping around the edges of his conscious mind. A weapon. Some way out of this. There had to be. He spotted one of Pelham's round needlepoint rugs in the center of the bedroom floor. There might be a way. His bedroom was directly above the sea. A long time ago, he'd had the crazy notion of installing a fireman's pole beneath his bedroom floor. His initial idea had been to use it to slide down the 20 or 30 feet to the narrow lagoon that lay just beneath his room. He'd envisioned it as a great way to wake up each morning, slide naked from his bed, grab the pole, and wake up in the clear, cold seawater. The novelty had soon worn off, but the pole was still there. He stepped to the center of his small room, lifted up the circular rug with the sailboat on it. Beneath it was the round hatch he disguised to match the rest of the wooden flooring, never thinking he'd need it as an escape hatch, but just have it, a secret, like a bookcase that swung open to reveal a hidden passage. He hooked his finger under an edge and lifted. Spider was hammering on the door with his fist, kicking it hard with his heavy boots, telling Hawk it was over, useless, time to die. It would be the work of a few moments before the powerful brute gained entry.
Yes.
20 feet directly below Hawk's room lay the small enclosed lagoon that opened out to the open sea. He could see the gleaming pole disappearing into the dark waves below, frothing up against the steep rocky walls. Angered, Spider was firing his weapon at the door, splintering the timbers. Hawk knew he didn't have long. He jumped, grabbed the pole, and slid down, lowering himself just a couple of feet. Then he reached up and pulled the hatch cover with its attached rug back into place. Even if Spider got inside the room now, well, he'd just bought himself a little time. A minute, maybe. Go. He let go of the hatch cover and let himself slide. The cold, dark water shocked him, pumping even more adrenaline into his system. He clawed at the water, kicking his feet as hard as he could, and swam, submerged, out of the inlet and into open sea. He gulped air as his head popped up above the surface, expecting to see the cottage up on the rocky promontory. Everything was black. No horizon, no landmarks. He whirled around, disoriented, looking for the shoreline. There. The misty garden lights up on his terrace. He started clawing water, swimming as hard as he could for land. A minute later, he reached a set of wide stone steps carved into the rock that ascended all the way up to his broad terrace. He pulled his weapon from its holster and raced to the top, taking the steps three at a time. There he was. Through an exterior window, he'd caught a glimpse of Spider Payne. He was still out in the hall, slamming his big shoulder against the splintering bedroom door over and over again, screaming loudly in frustration. Hawk sprinted across the terrace, slid open one of the doors, and stepped inside. The hallway leading to his room was to his immediate left. The house was still pitch black. He could hear the door begin to give way. Spider, illuminated only from the light from within the room, was seconds away from entering. Moving as quietly as he could, he entered to the darkened hall and paused. He knew he'd only get one shot at this. He felt along the wall with his left hand, searching for the overhead hall light switch. Spider was almost completely through the bedroom door. Hawk raised the Colt revolver, sighting on Spider's broad back as he paused to take a breath. Then he flipped the light switch. The corridor was instantly flooded with bright, incandescent light. Spider! He called out, the gun now extended with two hands in front of him, standing braced in a shooter stance. The big man whirled to face him, his own face a mask of shock and rage. Hawk saw the muzzle of the man's assault rifle come up, Spider already firing rounds, zinging off the tile floor as he raised the automatic weapon toward his enemy, hoping to cut him to ribbons. Hawk fired the python, once into the center of Spider's chest, hoping to catch the seam and his heart, and once into his right eye. The man's skull was slammed back against the door. He was still somehow struggling to lift his weapon as he fired blindly, round, still ricocheting off the tile floor as the life drained out of him. And then and there, Spider Payne breathed his last, sliding slowly to the floor, leaving a bloody smear on Alex Hawk's shattered bedroom door, collapsing into a shapeless black heap of useless flesh and bone. Hawk went to him, knelt down, and pressed two fingers to his carotid artery just to make sure. No pulse. The rogue was finally dead. Chapter 15. "Hello, Ambrose," Hawk said, answering his mobile a few moments later.
"Well, since it appears to be you on the phone, one can only deduce that you survived the encounter."
"Excellent deduction, Constable, one of your best. Do you require any assistance by chance?"
"Oh, that would be nice. Where are you? Drawing a quiet pipe by the fireside somewhere?"
"Hardly. I'm standing about 20 feet outside what used to be your front door, waiting in the pouring rain for all the shooting to die down in there."
"Ah, you're here then. Well, do come in, won't you? Door's open, as you can see," Hawk said.
"Meet me at the Monkey Bar, will you? Would seem to owe ourselves a libation, some sort of restorative, I suppose. What's your pleasure, old warrior?"
"A gin and bitter should do nicely. Boodles, if you have it."
"I certainly do.
And what about the deceased?"
"Oh, I don't think he'll be having anything this evening. He's moved on."
"Ah, well, good work, Alex. I'm on my way inside now. I'll see you at the bar."
"Cheerio, then."
"Cheerio."
Hawk looked down at the corpse at his feet. Brass cartridges glittered everywhere on the tiled floor. He used one bare foot to roll the man over on his back. Saw one dead black eye staring blindly back at him.
"I should have killed you that night in Tangiers, Payne," he said. "I could have done with one less funeral in Maine, you miserable bastard."
He found Ambrose standing behind the bar, his cold pipe jammed into one corner of his mouth, pouring a healthy dollop of rum into Hawk's favorite tumbler. Congreve smiled as he poured.
"Ah, the ambrosial nectar of the gods," he said.
"Indeed."
"Well, what should we drink to?"
Congreve asked, raising his glass of gin.
"Ah, well, let's see," Hawk mused.
He plucked one of the cigarettes from a silver stirrup cup on the bar, lit up, and thought about it a second before speaking.
"Absent friends and dead enemies," Hawk said, and that was the end of it.
White Death, Chapter 1, The Swiss Alps. It is often said that our greatest strength is also our greatest weakness. Lieutenant Christian Hartz, 10th Mountain Division, Swiss Army, was about to learn firsthand the terrible truth of that dusty old bit of wisdom. The lesson would be taught to this young fellow by a mountain. Der Nadel, the infamous Swiss Alp, was known to climbers around the world by its nickname, White Death, and for a very good reason. Christian toe-pointed the spiked crampons strapped to his boots into the vertical wall of sheer ice. He was able to kick the steel spikes at the toes of his boots a good 2 inches in. His lower body secure, he then secured his upper torso, swinging his ice axe into the wall high above his head, and then a second axe to lock him in. Firmly wed to the mountain, he leaned back and looked straight up. The towering vertical slab of ice and rock soared high into the clouds above him, finally disappearing into swirling gray mists that haunted the peak almost daily. He started moving again. At this point, the summit of the mountain was 15,330 feet above his head, roughly 3 miles straight up. The summit of Durnadal was at 25,430 feet above sea level. It was called the Needle because of the thin twisted spire that scratched the sky at the summit. Attempting to scale that spire had killed more climbers than any other mountain in Switzerland. So far, the lieutenant's moves had not been technically difficult. Still, the climbing was causing him continuous insecurity due to the Föhnströms, swirling about him as he went higher. A föhn is a downslope wind that occurs in the lee or downwind side of a high mountain range, like the moist winds off the Mediterranean Sea that sweep up over the Alps. Recent weather from the north had brought winds of 80-plus miles an hour, sub-zero temperatures, ice, and the relentless blinding snow. Still, Hartz had made good progress. The wide ledge on which he now stood, very secure for the moment, was known as Das Boot. The mammoth rock formation looked as if some giant battleship's entire bow section had suddenly blasted through the rock and now protruded from the mountain at 10,000 feet. A good place for tea. The lieutenant fired up his little stove and melted some snow in his pot. Earl Grey had never tasted so good. The good-looking soldier had been sent up the hill to find and bring safely down a lone climber, a young Italian woman who'd spent the night on a fingernail of rock, suffering in the 90-plus mile-an-hour winds and ice. For a long time, this climber had been the focus of the ranger station's high-powered optics. When dawn broke, she was gone. She'd either fallen, pitched forward into a hidden crevasse, or descended safely to a spot now hidden from sight. Lieutenant Hart's job was to find out which one was true and bring her down. Due to the weather, the chances that she was still alive and fighting for her survival were slim, but there was a chance. Christian reached up, stretching his body to the limit so his fingers could feel along the smooth face. He was looking for the next place where he could sink a pick or cam so he could haul himself up to the next pitch. He felt strong, but he'd been climbing since first light, and it had been painfully slow going, mostly due to the increasing winds and dropping temperatures as he gained altitude. 5 long hours later, his lats, biceps, and triceps were screaming in unison, and he hadn't even reached the hard part yet. But he knew it was coming. The hard part was next. The hard part was the north face of Durnadal, otherwise known as the Murder Wall. The infamous vertical face had long been called that, and for good reason. It was the last big hurdle one had to overcome before attacking the imposing summit. Of all those who'd risked their lives to conquer this final ascent, many had served, but few had been chosen. Lieutenant Hartz, now just 27 years old, had been acclaimed as the highest-ranking alpinist in his entire army division. He was proud of that. When he told his mom about it, she cried. He was number one out of some 10,000 Swiss soldiers, all of whom, like him, had been born on skis with axes in their hands. Highly skilled young men, fiercely determined, in peak condition for physical and mental strength, extreme high-altitude climbing, and most important of all, supreme confidence. That was your ticket up the hill. His timing couldn't have been worse. One of the most violent storms to rip through the canton in nearly a decade had arrived as if on cue, and he was on a time crunch. The lost climber's rescue clock had started ticking long before the first swing of his ice axe at dawn to begin his ascent. The woman could no longer be seen. She'd been on a narrow ledge high on the murder wall. She was now out of sight and out of communication range. Aerial searches by helicopters had not been successful, and the weather had finally grounded them. The young woman's last transmission had indicated that she had been gravely injured but was determined to survive. "I'll hold on," she had promised, "but please come soon." Christian's division commander had espoused the theory that the woman might well have found one of the old wooden escape doors built into the side of the mountain. Behind these doors were safety tunnels bored into the mountain over the centuries. The problem was that there were countless numbers of these doors up there, invisible fly specks spread across the massive north face. Classic needle in a haystack, Christian thought. His divisionnaire, Baron Wolfgang von Stuttka, known behind his back as Wolfie, had summoned Christian to his office just after midnight, given him the brief and said, "Lieutenant, please get your ass up there and find that young woman." And here he was. Darkness was closing in. It was now past 5 o'clock on that brutally cold gray afternoon in December. Lieutenant Hartz, trying to reach the same narrow ledge where the climber had been last seen, was struggling a bit. He was currently in the midst of an upward traverse across the lower section of that sheer wall, so smooth that it appeared almost polished. This part, the hard part, was challenging to the world's very best climbers, and he was only the best in the Swiss Army Division. Imagine climbing a couple of miles up a slightly cracked mirror, looking for invisible cracks, was how his 10th Mountain Division instructors had explained it to the new cadets. That message had sunk in with many of them, but many had not listened. Tales of the 10th Division versus the murder wall were legend. The number of cadets who died up there was a closely guarded secret, one that no one wanted to know. Chapter 2. In the 1930s, sporting climbers from all over the world began flocking to Switzerland as word of the impossible face spread. They came in droves, determined to conquer the needle-like summit. Topping out at 25,430 feet, the Nadel ranked with Everest and K2 as one of the deadliest mountains in the world. In a storm like this, it was the deadliest. Since the first climbers had attempted to conquer the North Face in 1933, over 75 men had died up there. Countless had been severely injured, and almost everyone lucky enough to survive had never gone anywhere near Der Nadel again. By the time Lieutenant Hartz had climbed 1,000 feet, insecurity had given way to the first hints of panic. Hartz paused to hammer in another titanium tube into the coat of ice. He missed the target, and his hammer careened off the rock. He felt himself starting to shake. The hardened steel trap that was the young soldier's mind was beginning to crack under the strain, cracks just wide enough to admit slivers of fear. Determined to fulfill his mission, Hartz kept climbing, his fingers searching for purchase, as new layers of thin ice coating made it ever more difficult. He swung his ice axe again and again, looking for another pick. His normally icy nerves continued to unravel with each swing of the axe. He realized he was now sweating profusely despite the sub-zero temperatures at that altitude, something he'd never done before. His bowels were dangerously close to the boiling point. He knew why. It was because he was now passing by certain early but prominent landmarks of Der Nadel. Crumbling outcroppings, ragged formations, rotten ice. All had given him nightmares as a young boy thumbing through his alpine picture books, dreaming of climbing in the Swiss Army. Crabbing gingerly across the broad slab of ice, he found that the wall steepened, the snow cover thinned, and his ice axe ricocheted off solid rock a few inches beneath the crust. With the advent of rotten ice at the higher elevations, Christian now felt a nauseous anxiety that shook him to the core. He felt the only thing preventing him from cartwheeling off into space was a pair of two thin titanium bolts sunk half an inch into rotten ice. Ice that looked like the inside of his freezer when it badly needed defrosting. Then came the first truly stupid mistake of the day. Lieutenant Hartz looked down. He saw the ground spinning more than 9,000 feet below, and suddenly felt woozy. Even dizzy, as if he was about to faint. He wrestled mightily for control of his once stalwart mind and took a dozen deep breaths before he could resume climbing. Normally, his steely confidence made short work of encroaching panic, crowding it out. It had been his greatest strength. Now he wondered if it would soon become his downfall. This time, to his mounting horror, everything was different. It had taken him 6 tortured hours to climb a mere 4,800 feet up the face. Hartz figured he had maybe 3 more hours of reasonable daylight to reach the roughly calculated area he'd been assigned to scout for a survivor. The weather was deteriorating so rapidly that he was at the point where it looked as if he might soon be needing that rescue door himself. He paused to check his altimeter, and a new kind of fear crept into his reeling mind on silent tiptoes. Based on his current rate of ascent, he knew that only two scenarios were now even possible. One, best case, he'd actually find the door and the climber behind it would be alive. He'd take shelter inside the mountain with her for the night, ride out the storm, and get her down next morning. But it was a night that promised nothing good. It was already shaping up to be wretched from any perspective. Thornstorms, heavy snowfall and high winds were increasing the chance of avalanches and thundering rock slides by a factor of 10. Worst case, he might never even reach the altitude where he might find that door, much less rescue anyone. If worst did prove to be the case, it meant that he'd have to stop climbing, and soon. He'd need somewhere, anywhere, to spend the night. Perched on some craggy overhang, some random narrow ledge where he could huddle against the rock, totally unprotected from the raging elements. And even worse scenario? There would be no ledge at all. He would be forced to hang, suspended, from two anchors embedded perhaps 1/4 inch into crumbly rock and ice, hanging in space and twisting in a violent icy wind. An entire night of darkness, dangling at 10,000 feet in the middle of a Category 4 hurricane. He shook his head and tried to clear his trembling mind. He had little choice but to continue moving up the face. Duty dictated that decision. But the longer he climbed and the wearier and more unsure he grew, the more he began to question the wisdom of his decision to keep on going. He was moving at a snail's pace, doing a long end run around yet another wide ledge protruding from the rock just above him. He felt dizzy, like he might faint. He had to take a few minutes' rest before he could resume climbing. And when he resumed, he tried to regain his focus by thinking of something else, anything else, as he moved upward across the face. After half an hour, he came within sight of a familiar landmark above. His platoon called that imposing strip awning of rock De Flughafen. In English, that means the airport, the departure lounge to the Eternal Kingdom, God's waiting room. If it was a joke, as some people said, he didn't get it. There was nothing remotely amusing about getting under that damn overhang before he even had a shot of climbing on top of it. The crumbling rock wall here was coated with 2 inches of ice. Thin though the layer was, it was still enough to hold his ice axe in place if he swung it slowly. He kept moving, praying for any change in his luck. He was certainly due one. And that's when he saw an old frayed rope someone had left behind. A line that emerged intermittently from the glazing and continued upward across the face. Some long-ago climber he'd never know had left him a lifeline. Nearly paralyzed with fear, and desperate for anything at all that might subdue his mounting panic, Christian was shamelessly and very dangerously grabbing at bits of old rope wherever they were visible. Any slip now would send him plummeting to the bottom of the wall, 8,000 feet of free fall, with no chute and no God to save him. He went higher, foolishly holding his breath to calm deepening anxiety he'd never known before. Now he started thinking that his much-vaunted confidence had put him up here. And now that that same cocksure attitude that had been his lifelong cornerstone was going to send him to his death, he could almost feel his confidence seeping out through his pores. Still, he climbed higher toward his objective, looking for each new shred of frayed rope, literally grasping at straws as he scaled the murder wall. Chapter 3. The whole spectrum of the face was in atrocious condition, far worse than he'd expected. It was plastered with rime and loaded with unstable snow. He was now officially shit out of luck. There was nowhere left to go, no place to... He saw the rope dangling 2 feet away. He lunged for it, and that's when he made the worst mistake of his short life. He made a single misstep in a game where that's all it took. Both of his ice axes and the spiky crampons on his boots sheared out of rotten ice at the same moment. Hartz found himself airborne, the wind tearing at his clothes as he hurtled downward. They say time slows down just before you die, that you revisit all the important scenes from your life like a movie. It's all bullshit. You fall off a mountain, and 3 seconds later, you're a bug on the windshield of life. He only knew he was alive because his eyes popped open on the world. He pinched his mind to see if this could be real. He was numbingly cold and couldn't feel his feet, but he tried to move his legs and succeeded. It was real. Slowly, painfully, he lifted his head from the powdery snow and surveyed his immediate surroundings. Ice, rock, sky. How in God's name had he gotten here? Moving his arms and legs to increase circulation, he soon discovered the reason for his miraculous salvation. Incredibly, he'd landed on a ledge he had not known even existed. He'd fallen at least 500 feet when the frayed rope had parted. He could almost make out the bitter end of it twisting in the wind high above him. Had rock, ice, or granite been below him, he would have died instantly. Instead, his landing had been cushioned by a heavy accumulation of crushed and powdery snow. The stuff must have been falling hard while he'd been struggling up there, fearing for his future. God had saved him after all. He lay there for a long while, thanking everybody up there, thinking of his small family, Sandra, Willie, and his dog Ludwig, waiting for him to come home to them that night. That he would see his wife and daughter again seemed a miracle. He lay there like that for a long time, exhausted, dreaming of home, and fell asleep with a smile on his face. After a while, he woke and felt himself strong enough and reasonably clear-headed enough to climb out of the snowbank and start looking for a feasible route of descent. The weather and ice prohibited going further. He snapped on the halogen light on his helmet, miraculously still there. Slowly, he made his way lower. He'd been able to walk away from the fall with no more damage than bruises and a painful crimp in his back. The sharp back pain actually helped keep him alert. Presently, he came to a yawning crevasse that he would certainly have stumbled into had it not been for the powerful headlamp. Now, carefully retracing his steps and circumventing the crevasse, his crampons gave him good traction across the treacherous ice field. He picked his way down with his axe, seeing some of the same holes he'd used on the way up. He'd been climbing downward for about a half an hour when he crested a broad slab of ice. He saw something that caused him to think he was really losing his mind. He blinked his eye, sure he was still delusional from the panic attack and the fall, because what he saw atop a mound of snow a few feet below his feet defied all logic. It was a head. Not a skull, but a decapitated human head, with a pair of horn-rimmed glasses buried in the snow a few feet away. The head was perched almost playfully atop a large snowdrift. There was a thin crust of ice on the head's face. Christian knelt down on one knee and studied his find more carefully. He clawed some crusty ice away, trying to free the head from the ice beneath the jaw, but it had frozen. The dead man's head was cemented in place. He could see that it was male. The features were still discernible, Caucasian. The nose misshapen from a fall. Dark blonde hair, matted with dark black blood. Not an old guy, maybe early 40s. The mouth, too, was frozen, opened in a permanent rictus of scream. The teeth were all shattered or missing. The blue eyes had also locked up, in the open position. The most bizarre thing of all? There was a total absence of tracks in the snow around the head. No signs of foul play, nor any footprints anywhere near the vicinity. A freak snowfall? Yet now there was this human head sitting on the snow. And a pair of eyeglasses. Impossible, but that was exactly what he saw. The following is the missing persons report Lieutenant Hartz filed with the Swiss Army Military Police at Zurich HQ, immediately upon his return from his failed rescue attempt in the Southern Alps. Male, Caucasian, approximately 40 years of age, close-cropped blonde hair, light blue eyes, 2-inch scar on the left cheek, teeth broken or missing, massive contusion inside the hairline at the right temple, left ear missing, no further evidence or description possible at this time. Signed, Lieutenant Christian Hartz, 10th Mountain Division, Swiss Army. Chapter 4, London.
God, how I hate these bloody things,
Chief Inspector Ambrose Congreve said. He was struggling to keep both his putter and his spindly golf umbrella under control in an unexpected blizzard. Nearly whiteout conditions were not ideal for his golf score. Lord Alexander Hawke, who much preferred the name Alex, smiled at his old golf partner and even older friend, a currently snow-coated former Scotland Yard chief inspector.
Would you mind putting, Constable? I mean, while we're still young? I can't see the bloody hole, can I?
Congreve shouted with a trace of frustration.
So what? You can't get it in even when you can see the bloody hole, so putt.
It was December, a Saturday, a day on which no sane man in England would venture out onto a golf course, but Ambrose Congreve and Alex Hawke made no claims regarding their sanity. Only their passion for the grand old game of golf dictated their actions. A coating of light snow and frost had painted the trees and the fairways a fairy tale white. The sudden sight of nasty weather had made one of them inexplicably cheery, and the other one rather not. The two sportsmen were on the treacherous fifth green at Hawke's beloved Sunningdale Golf Club just north of London, a difficult par four, and the bane of Inspector Congreve's existence, most especially on this particularly insalubrious Saturday morning. Congreve, who carried his weight around his circumference, was attempting to squat down and line up his putt, somewhat in the manner of Tiger Woods, the new Tiger, not the old Tiger. Suffice it to say, it was not a pretty sight. And that sudden wind had come, howling up and down the wide fairway, and the icy particles, and the blinding snow. Hawke, who'd always nursed a secret love of foul weather, was stoic, braving the gale-force winds, standing rooted to the snowy green, his frozen putter in his hand, a smile frozen on his face. He was watching Ambrose struggling with his wild umbrella, trying to keep his footing on the treacherous ice. Perhaps the hurricane will simply loft you and your errant brawley up and away into the heavens, just like Mary Poppins in the Disney film of the same name, he said. Ambrose shouted above the wind, and hopefully I'll be dropped off somewhere near the bloody clubhouse, hopefully in the middle of the men's grill room. There's a crackling fire blazing in the hearth right now, you know, Alex. Warmth, whiskey, and not a wife in sight. Shut up and putt, Ambrose. Then get out of the way, will you? You're standing directly in my line, Congreve cried above the wind, waving putter and umbrella around in a rage of frustration. Hawke said, how am I supposed to know where your line is when it's covered with snow? They were the only twosome either brave enough or foolish enough to be out on the links this frightfully winter morning. Fiendishly icy winds and wet snow were terrorizing the few souls who'd not retreated to the grill. Congreve's putt was well wide of the mark. It slid 30 feet past the cup, gathered speed on a sheet of black ice, narrowly missed a frozen water hazard, then trickled down into the snow-filled sand trap. He would be now hitting an 8. May I? Hawke said, standing over his nearly invisible ball, which lay 3. He was looking at Congreve deferentially, but with just a titch of schadenfreude. Just putt. Lord Hawke promptly sang a smashing 15-footer, even though he couldn't see it disappear into a slight depression that had marked the cup's location.
Oh, 4. That's par,
Hawke said, pumping his fist in the air as he bent down to pluck his ball from the hole.
Par, Ambrose snorted. No, surely you did not say the par word, Alex. Hardly a par, my dear boy. Bogey or double bogey at the very best.
Hawke was indignant.
Count them. Drive into the middle of the fairway, lying one. No mulligan. Two, into the fairway trap. Three, chipped onto the green. Four, sank the putt. Par.
No, not four, Alex. Not even close. Let me think about it. Six.